is Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirits Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Welcome to the unofficial start of the weekend here in the Crescent City. Thanks for tuning in today, friends. If you've been listening to the show for the past 7 or 8 weeks or so, and I hope you have, and I hope you've been listening longer, but for the past 7 or 8 weeks, you'll know that we tend to sort of, or I tend to start off the show here with a bit of a, how shall I say, a thinly veiled joke, referencing 45 there, and then moving kind of right along. And hey, I'm not a comedy writer, but often this stuff just seems to kind of write itself. And you know, I'm fortunate enough to have a voice that is louder than most, both or than some, I should say, both literally and figuratively. I'm very fortunate to have this opportunity to talk to you once a week and explore the world of drinking food in New Orleans and beyond. And, you know, this week it just doesn't seem right to start with humor. So on a more serious note, I think everybody should be outraged by what has occurred recently or continues to occur. People say that, you know, how did we get here? How did this get so bad? It's always been like this. Okay. This is just, it's just more out in the open now. And maybe that's something that's a benefit of what's gone on. But these recent events that took place in Charlottesville and other places around the country, we should all be outraged by this. Yes, this is not a political show, friends. And you know, we can argue political points or policy points, and you can be of one political ilk or another. And I'm not going to go down the road of what might be considered a policy that has a moral issue implication, something like healthcare. I'm not going to go down that road. But in this particular situation, you cannot create a moral equivalency to hate groups and those that stand up against hate. Nazis and white supremacists are wrong. We fought a world war over this. The whole world, for the most part, went to war to fight this threat. This is not about two sides, okay? It's about right and wrong. There's only one side, and that side is a side that is standing up against what is wrong, and hate groups are wrong. And again, I don't really care what your political viewpoints are from this standpoint, but in this particular instance, everyone, as I said, should be outraged by this. And let me say this also. No one is stealing from you by asserting their rights. No one is trying to replace you. No one is taking anything away from you. One group asserting their rights doesn't diminish yours. It is not a pie. Once somebody gets, there's no taking a slice and then there's less pie for you. In this country, what we're supposed to be about is everyone is supposed to enjoy these rights. It's what's guaranteed to us. Okay. It's in the Constitution. No one is taking anything away from you. Now you may say, okay, this show is about drinking food, and yes, it is. So let's bring it back to drinking food. Sure, we can do that. Here in New Orleans, we're going to use that as an example. And I say this on the show all the time. Our economy in the city of New Orleans in this area, by and large, depends on tourism. And the tourism sector, you've heard me say this 100 times, probably, the tourism sector depends on the service industry, those who work in tourism, which primarily in New Orleans, in our case of the world, and presenting music and food and drink, it's the service industry. And a lot of people in this city who work in the service industry are people of color, people who are also working hard, people trying to build a career, trying to make their way in the world, and in many cases with things stacked against them. You know, one of the things that I think here is that in New Orleans, you know, people ask me, like, why do you have musicians on the show? Well, here in New Orleans, the world of drink and food and music, it's all a tapestry, is what I like to say. And you can't pull the threads of those tapestry. It's part of who we are. They're all interconnected. The music, the food, the drink, the culture. That should be inclusive of everyone. We are, friends, a town, supposedly, and I think it's true, that reveres cooks and trumpet players, as we like to say. Well, in many cases, these folks that are cooks, that are basically supporting our economy in many ways, cooking terrific food for you, trumpet players that are playing music, many of these people are African-American people, okay? And if we want to revere these people, which I think we do, and I think we should, then we have to realize that these people, you can't have it both ways. You can't revere or depend on a group and then deny them their rights. That is just wrong. we need equal opportunity to access to inclusion. A lot of these people, a lot of African Americans and others, of course, work in the back of house. They're working as cooks. They're working as dishwashers. They're working as delivery drivers, bringing food supplies and bringing beers and things like that to Bourbon Street and all of this kind of stuff. Opportunity must be created for people to by merit and the opportunity to earn merit, okay? It's hard when barriers and things are stacked against you to have opportunities to advance and build a career, become a chef, own a distributorship, become a server as opposed to just being a dishwasher. These sorts of things, this type of inclusion, we're a long, long, long way from that. We should never be threatened by anyone who, by merit, is able. And like I said, that's a tricky thing. The avenues being open for people to establish and demonstrate their merit has to be a reality. And we are far, far from that. And I think it's important that we recognize that if we want to support our economy, we want to revere cooks and trumpet players here in New Orleans or really anywhere, then we need to realize who these people are and the reality of what this means, and not mincing words. Hate groups and those that would put these people down, hate groups and those that would suppress the rights of anyone are wrong, and we should all be outraged by that. And yes, in the world of drink and food, there is a lot that matters here, and there is a lot of connection to it. There are groups out there, Cafe Hope and Cafe Reconcile spring to mind, trying to teach life skills and bring opportunities to people who maybe would not necessarily have them, and to build a career. Go support those groups. Go support the restaurants and establishments that are inclusive, or at least working towards being inclusive in who it is that they are trying to hire. I think we know who those people are. We can find who those people are. Ask those questions when you're at those establishments. What is their philosophy? We all have a responsibility for this, friends. We all have a responsibility to stand up against what is wrong. So thank you. That's what I wanted to say for the most part. We have a good show coming up here for you. Lots more interviews from our time at Tales of the Cocktail. Yeah, it's a gold mine of stuff that I'm sitting on here. We're going to talk to, after the break here, we're going to talk to Miriam Hendricks, who is the owner and master distiller at Rutte, Rutte Distillery in the Netherlands. We're going to talk about gin and Geneva. Then we're going to move on. We're going to talk about Pisco, one of my favorite subjects. Got to three wonderful guests at an event the Peruvian government put on. Erica Ponte comes up first. Erica works with the Peruvian embassy, actually their trade commission based out of Miami. They're big supporters, of course, of Pisco as a product. Then very honored to be joined by two luminaries in the Pisco world, Diego Loe de Mola, who is the owner of Barsol Pisco, and then Johnny Schuler, who is the owner of Pisco Portón. Really interesting conversation about Pisco in general, and again, luminaries there. Then Paul Hletko from Few Spirits, F-E-W Spirits. It's a really interesting guy making craft distilled spirits in Chicago. Really cool stuff. And then we're going to be back to close out the show. So I hope you enjoy these interviews. Lots of interesting things that we're talking about here in the world of Tales of the Cocktail and exploring the world, as I always say, of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. We're going to take a little break here, and we're going to be right back, starting off with Miriam Hendricks from Rutte. Come on back.
Girl, it may be true. Honey, I may be the fool. Over here smiling and winking and making lies at you.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass Wine you drink.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu, life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Maine. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian D is here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in the podcast land, wherever you are listening to the show on planet Earth. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Yes, we are here. Technically, day number 4 of Tales of the Cocktail. We're still alive. It's been a feat. But, you know, we'll circle back and let you know how things go. And as you know, we're playing all kinds of... talking to all kinds of interesting people and interviewing people, and today is no exception. I'm pleased to be joined by Miriam Hendricks from Root. Miriam, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome to New Orleans as well.
Oh, yeah. It's been wonderful.
Great. Great. And you're surviving Tales of the Cocktail as well. At this point in the week, it does become a little bit of an issue of survival, I think.
Well, yeah. Not just so much for the drinking for me, but a lot of activities, running from left to right, going everywhere. But yeah, that's what we're here for. So yeah, it's
that's
great.
Right. That's right. And you're exactly right. We're not really talking about the drinking part by itself. It is a whirlwind of activities. You have to take advantage of being here, people to see, people to meet.
Exactly.
We were just speaking before we went on the air a little bit about how there's a sort of, well, I don't know, I don't want to say irony, but in a misfortune, we'll say that when people come to town for Tales, you don't ever get to see any of New Orleans because you see Tales.
Yeah, you see Tales, you see two streets, basically, yeah, and that's it. And there's so many activities that you get half an hour in your hotel and you're off again to the next thing.
Exactly.
So you don't see New Orleans, you have to pronounce.
Either way.
In Europe, we say New Orleans. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so yeah, you don't get to see it, which is a real pity because it's such a great town and I'm so curious to know more about it.
Well, we'll be happy to have you back outside of Tales sometime. Hey, we'll have you on the radio show then, too. You can come to the radio station and we'll do something. But we don't want it to be all about work then, either, so we want to make sure you see some of the city. But tell us a little bit about Root. Tell us a little bit about the company and what you do, and then tell us a little bit about how you got involved and what you do.
Okay. Well, the distillery in Dutch, we say Rutte, which is very difficult for Americans, Rutte. But the distillery is almost 150 years old. It got founded in 1872 by Simon Rutte. And today we've got a Geneva called Old Simon. Of course, that's named after him. So it's a 150-year-old distillery, very small and very traditional, handcraft, small batch. And we are botanical distillers.
Okay.
That means our craft is to get fruits and herbs and spices, get the best possible flavor out of them, and then mix it together in a liquid, in a Geneva or gin, in the best possible way.
Got it. And I probably should tell people where you are. I don't think we actually touched on where you are on the planet Earth. That's
not true. We're in the Netherlands, uh-huh, where Geneva comes from. Geneva is the forerunner of gin. And it all started in the Netherlands. So we are right there. And we're in a town called Dordrecht, which is half an hour drive from Rotterdam. We're below sea level, just like you guys here.
We were talking about that, too. We share that in common. Yep.
Yep.
Right. Okay. Great.
And the Dutch are real traders, as a lot of people know. We've been sailing the planet for centuries.
Right.
And so we have a big tradition in botanicals coming from all over the world. And for a distiller, it was, at the time, and still is, the best place to be, right in the middle of town, close to the harbors.
Okay.
Where all the beautiful stuff came in.
That makes sense. And so with the botanicals that you all use, typically, are you sourcing them from many, many countries, many places? Or are they mostly local, a mix?
No, they're all over the world, and that has to do with this Dutch history.
Okay, right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense. So, you just do gin and Geneva, is that correct? Or do you do some
other
things?
We do everything.
As well? Oh, you do?
But
okay.
We do focus on gin and Geneva.
Okay.
But we still have the original shop as well, which is 150 years old. Mm-hmm. So in the shop, we sell anything. You know, that was also a little bit from the tradition onwards. People just wanted, the family Rutte just wanted to be able to provide any spirit drink.
Right.
So we make everything, but there's just small things and local stuff. So we basically focus on gin and Geneva. Yes.
Okay, great. Well, let's taste the dry gin first, I guess, is where we're starting, right?
Yes.
And we actually have two dry gins. So, and that would be this one. So I'm going to have a sip if you don't mind. And tell us a little bit about this while I'm sipping.
Well, we have a dry gin. The first dry gin we made was in the 30s of last century. Funnily enough, we're a Geneva country, but the fashion in the United States sort of blew back to Europe, and we made gin in the 30s for the first time. And this recipe is based on that. And it's a standard dry gin. What's special about it, it's got fresh oranges.
Ah, okay, yes.
Really fresh fruit that we peel by hand, and that's really special. Nobody is doing that because it's a lot of work.
That makes sense.
But we enjoy that. And it has also typical things that you see in a lot of gins, like juniper and coriander and angelica.
Now, you say that about the orange, and that it's very noticeable. And I think one of the things that's very nice about that and unique, oftentimes, as you know, Miriam, with gins or any distillates, really, when your orange as a citrus flavor will tend to sort of have a medicinal taste or a sort of, I always say, furniture polish kind of taste. And so the freshness of the orange juice actually shows very nicely in that.
Yeah, so orange can be sharp.
Absolutely.
Sharp. And the fresh orange really smells, well, you know, maybe obvious, but you peel an orange yourself, and the minute the smell hits your nose, that's the smell we catch in the pot still when we distill fresh oranges.
That's very nice. I like that a lot. Great. So, let's try the next one. Let's try the next dry gin.
Well,
then.
The next one is also a dry gin, but the special, we also call it celery gin because this one has celery in it.
Okay.
And that is super special. We've been using celery in the distillery for over 100 years. It's for us a very common botanical. We don't use the sticks, but we use celery leaf.
The leaf. Okay, that makes sense.
And the great thing about this gin is that the celery is not a dominant flavor. It's not a flavor gin. But the celery is in the background and gives it like a savory, umami
Absolutely.
Kind of feel to it.
Absolutely, and it's very noticeable. And I this, to be honest with you, that this is much more my style to taste.
Yeah.
Actually, the celery, as you said, it's really important. I think a lot of people misunderstand celery.
Yeah.
And don't, you know, they kind of take it for granted with lots of things. And it's a wonderful ingredient in cocktails in general and as well as a botanical, as you said.
Yeah, it's incredible that the Ritter family already a century ago thought of celery as a botanical for gin and Geneva. It's also in our Old Simon.
Okay.
As it gives, like I said, the savory note. And when we think of celery, normally we think of the sticks that are in a salad, for example. And that's a different taste. Of course, it has flavors in common with the leaves, but it's different. The leaves are more fine and more savory,
as you said, and they're more intense as well
exactly.
than the stalks as well. Yep. Well, that's very nice. I'm going to have one more. So are these, the recipes for all three here, do they go back to the late 19th century typically?
Well, we are going to taste the Geneva in a minute, and that one goes back to the original founder. The gins are tweaks to the original recipes from the 30s.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's do this then. So let's go ahead and we'll taste the Geneva. And let's, Miriam, if you don't mind, let's tell people a little bit about what Geneva actually is. Can we get a little bit of history from you on that?
Of course. Of course. It's very important that people realize, I think, Geneva is the forerunner of gin. So these days, gin is, you know, sold and drunk all over the world, but it started in the Netherlands in 1600. Around 1600, the first Geneva was produced and shipped by boat. So we took botanicals in from all over the world, but we shipped Geneva out. And Geneva was a big thing, a big export thing. Its heyday being around 1880. And the first cocktails in the United States were not made with dry gin because there was no dry gin.
There was
right. Dutch Geneva.
Yep.
So Geneva is really the forerunner. And today, they're two different things. The dry gin had its own development. It's a neutral alcohol. It has citrus, whereas Geneva doesn't have citrus. And the big difference is Geneva still has the multi-grainy base alcohol.
Right.
And that's
ahead,
the big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And that part comes through very clearly. What's the grain that's used on your Geneva?
In this Geneva, we use four grains, corn, rye, wheat, and barley.
Okay, right. Yeah. And then obviously, because we're talking about a clear distillate, we're doing radio. But so this is stainless steel tanks. Stainless steel tanks is what we're
aging.
No,
we distill the botanicals in a copper pot still.
In the copper pot still, but then is there any resting or anything like that? Is that done?
Yeah, first we infuse the botanicals for at least a day, and then we distill them. But in this particular case, our recipes, because we're so old and we didn't change them, our recipes are very complicated. We use 12 botanicals in this one, but they're divided over 3 different distillates and 2 infusions.
Okay.
So we actually make 5 fluids.
Okay.
And especially the infusions take months to make.
Right.
And then in the end, everything gets mixed with the base alcohol, which is very grainy, and a bit of sugar, which is very typical for old Geneva styles. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite a complicated product to make.
That makes a lot of sense. One of my very favorite cocktails, Miriam, is called Death in the Gulfstream. And that's a Geneva-based cocktail. And a friend of mine some years ago here in New Orleans made it for me. And that's actually what turned me on to Geneva.
Right.
I don't want to say an alternative to gin because it's a different thing, but that's a great drink.
Yeah, for us it's great. Also, what we did in what we do in classes and in seminars, we, for example, make a Martinez. It's a classic American cocktail, but we do one with gin and one with Geneva, and we put them next to each other, and they're both very nice, but they're both very different.
Yeah.
So, and we want people to learn and appreciate the differences. That, for example, the Martinez with gin is sharp and dry and citrusy, and the Martinez with Geneva is round and complex and more mellow.
Right.
And they're two different things, and you could put a modern Martinez on your menu, but also a classic Martinez with Geneva, which is really exciting, we think.
That's a great way to do it, and I think tasting things side by side. A lot of people, I always say this, Miriam, that, especially in anything with spirits, wine, we tend to drink in a monolithic way is the word that I use, because we tend to have a bottle that we share with our friends or whomever we're doing, and people don't often take the opportunity or find the opportunity to taste something side by side. The ability to compare and contrast, I think, is really important in developing tasting skills, as well as developing a taste for what it is that you actually like and can articulate why you like it.
That's exactly what you say. You do have to do a lot of tasting, and comparison really teaches you.
Yep.
Yeah, it's very important. We do it all the time, really. And still, you know, at the distillery, we just taste all day. We don't drink all day, but we taste all day.
We were talking about that, but we're all professionals here. So there you go. It's tasting all day. Well, Miriam, do me a favor. We got about 30 seconds left. Can you tell people where we can find Ruta online with the website?
It's ruta.com, RUTTE, ruta.com. And there you have our website. You have lovely cocktail recipes and a description of our most important products, the ones that are available in the U.S.
Great. Thank you very much. I know we're working on getting it here into Louisiana. So, Miriam, thank you so much for the hospitality. The tasting was a pleasure chatting with you today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Friends, we were just chatting with Miriam Hendricks from Ruta, and I'm kind of getting that closer to being right. Not exactly right. I'll never get it right. And, hey, we're going to talk a little bit more from Tales of the Cocktail. Come on back to the NOLA Drink Show.
The French Market offers daily entertainment and delicious food and drink options throughout our 6-block district. Whether you crave raw oysters or fresh produce, authentic confections or healthy daiquiris, you can find it here. Sit at one of our cafes and hear live local music. Enjoy a muffaletta, po' boy, salad, or cheese plate in the farmer's market. Check out our pop-up farmer's markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays for even more fresh food options. History is being made fresh daily at the French Market. Visit frenchmarket.org for food, drink, retail, and event listings.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. It's football and festival season, and there's no better way to enjoy Sazerac Rye than in a pothole cocktail. Just fill up a glass with ice and your favorite root beer, and add 2 ounces of Sazerac Rye for a truly tasty toddy. Named after the city's most iconic of inconveniences, the pothole is proof that New Orleans never takes itself too seriously. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
Hello, this is Ron Bartholomew, and to my great city of New Orleans, I'd like to introduce to you Touch Vodka. This artisan handcrafted ultra-premium vodka is uniquely distilled from Florida's finest wildflower honey and American grain. Touch also produces key lime, Valencia orange, and ruby red grapefruit selections that are infused with natural oils of locally sourced fruit, which results in a unique 80-proof vodka with no sugar added or coloring. Touch is now available at Doranax, Cello's, and the Corporation Grill and Bar, and many other locations across Louisiana. This holiday season, sit back and relax and enjoy Touch Vodka.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc, a crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, this Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint. And it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc. Cheers!
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WTSO 990 AM in New Orleans. We are here at Tales of the Cocktail 2017. And kicking things off, at least here as we do the show, we are at a special event put on by the Peruvian Embassy. It's all about Pisco, and I'm pleased to be joined by Eric Aponte, who is the Trade Commissioner with the Peruvian Embassy. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. It's a great event, you guys. First day of Tales of the Cocktail, and you guys are starting things off with a little Pisco for us.
That's it. We do decide in this program, Make It, Eat It, Drink It, which gives people the opportunity not only to learn about Pisco, but also to learn how to make their own ceviche. So it's a little bit of a combination of the gastronomy and the Pisco in one.
That's a nice pairing right across the board. They go really well together.
Absolutely.
Well, and as I was saying to you, Eric, right before we went on the air here, that we've done a fair bit here on the NOLA Drink Show about Pisco. It's a lot of people in New Orleans and other folks have been on. But this is something a little bit different. As somebody from the Peruvian Embassy and doing the Trade Commission stuff that you do, let's talk a little bit about what you do and then tell us a little bit about how the embassy is getting behind the beverage.
Okay. The Trade Commission is actually part of the Ministry of Foreign Trade and Tourism of Peru. So we're a foreign arm of them here in the United States. We have 4 offices, my office in Miami, one in Washington, D.C., one in New York, and one in Los Angeles. So each of us has a region we oversee where we promote Peruvian exports, Peruvian tourism, and Peruvian foreign direct investment. So obviously one of our major products that we want to promote is Pisco because it's our national drink. It's Peru's. Peru has the history. We have 1,000 different drinks we can make with it, but most people don't really realize that. They just think Pisco Sour and that's it. They don't go beyond that. So we're here to educate the bartenders and the community about how to use Pisco. And luckily we were able to get people of the level of Tony Abuganim and Dale DeGroff, which is unprecedented, really, to have them both in one event. And they're here supporting it because they love the category, not because we're throwing a lot of money at them, because we are not.
right. And that's you bring up something really interesting, because it is a growing category. I think people are very interested in it now. One of the things that we know it is, it's been around for a long time. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, mm-hmm. So you know there's a long history there, and we talked about it on the show very recently, so I won't go down that road. How long has the embassy been kind of getting behind Pisco officially? Has this been going on for some time?
It's always been a product that we were tasked with promoting, but it's always up to the individual offices how they determine the best method to do that promotion. It wasn't until the last 5 or 6 years that we really began making it a common focus where we were all attacking the same end user, which in this case isn't the drinker, it's really the bartender for us. The bartender becomes our quote-unquote ambassador, because they're the ones, once they learn about it and they know how to use it, they realize how versatile it is. They go to their bar owner or their distributor and say, we need this on our bar. Go find us some Pisco. And so that's how we've really found the success. It's really been through the bartenders, and that's been critical.
Now, Eric, you said so you're originally from Peru, as you said, and you grew up in Lima or just outside of Lima?
In Callao, yes.
Yeah.
Just outside of Lima.
And now you've been in the United States for quite some time, you said?
Yeah. 3 decades.
In Florida and Miami in particular?
Florida, Chicago, Dallas, Philadelphia, I've been around a bit.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as your family goes then, did you grow up with Pisco in your life, or did your family grow up with Pisco in their life? Has it always been something that you've been close to personally?
My family has. They didn't prepare that many. It's mostly been a household. When we would have the get together with the family, the Pisco would come out. If it was more something like just friends of the family or getting together and we're talking smaller groups, then they would go to the more traditional U.S. or not U.S. drinks, but the more traditionally known drinks like your vodka, your rum, etc. But once you get the whole Peruvian family together, the very first thing that comes out is that Pisco. That's what everybody wants. And that's the feeling we want to get to the masses here. We want people to realize just how good a spirit it is.
It's a beautiful spirit. And, you know, to this point, too, one of the things that we've talked about on the show before, Eric, and what you've just touched on, which I appreciate, thank you, is it is a very important beverage culturally. It's culturally integrated into the Peruvian landscape. And I think sometimes, and as a lot of these things are, we talk about mezcal in Mexico and these things. So when the families get together, somebody's birthday, right, or celebrating the birth of the child, these sorts of things, Pisco has traditionally been embedded in the culture. Is that fair
absolutely,
to say?
Without a doubt. Yes, I absolutely would agree with that.
Now, with the number of brands, we're starting to see more and more brands, obviously, I'm sure, thanks to your good work and others getting this out here. Do we expect that there's more on the way? I mean, and I know how in Louisiana, where we are here, distribution laws are as they are. Again, not a topic for the show today. But we are seeing more Pisco on the market, more brands on the market.
Yes. Every year, there's been double-digit growth in the category. And that has attracted more interest from the producers in Peru, of which there's literally hundreds. So once they begin to look outside of the local market in Peru, usually one of the first two markets that they look at is either the United States or Chile, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. So the United States draws a ton of interest because of the size of its market. And because if you are able to make it here in this market, you're probably going to make it anywhere at that point. Once you learn, there's so many trials and tribulations any brand of any spirit has to go through in order to make it in the United States. So here, that's what we're trying to get our Piscos to do, is really be embedded here, because that will teach you so much about getting into any other market that you learn how to fight for yourself here. You're going to fight anywhere,
right? Especially in the state. If you can get into the state, you've worked the system well. Yeah. Have you guys been focusing on particular markets as part of your strategy? Are you looking at places like New Orleans, New York, San Francisco? I'm guessing, is that kind of part of the plan?
Yeah, initially it was the two coasts. Mm-hmm. It was the East Coast and West Coast. But we've actually been able to increase the number of brands, as you said, there pretty well. So now we're beginning to move into the heartland. We want to get Texas. Texas is a really high priority market for us. Louisiana as well. And once we get into that heartland, we'll have reached another level, because we need, especially when it comes to Texas, we need people to understand that Pisco is not a competitor to tequila. It's simply a different spirit.
Very different, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, with all these different brands that are coming, that you said hundreds of brands in Peru, should we expect to find more in the States coming? Are there more in line that want to get in here and do that
absolutely
kind of thing?
I think we should probably, within the next 5 years, if we don't have twice as many brands as we have now, I'd be surprised. I would be.
Now, are there programs that are going on, Eric, in Peru to support some of the producers down there and helping them maybe expand their production or develop their market savvy, these sorts of things? You know, it's obviously, as we're talking about, tricky to get into some of these markets. Are there things that the government are doing to help the growers, help the producers make this happen?
Particularly during this current administration that started about a year ago, the concentration on making sure that we maintain the quality of Pisco and its production in Peru has increased dramatically. So that's something that's going from the homeland, we'll say, to make sure our quality remains the same. And then you get Prom Peru in our offices, which we do the same work, but we're actually separate offices, where the Prom Peru helps them prepare to learn how to physically export the product. And where our offices come in is we find them the market to bring their product to. So that's how we all work together. There's a, that the Ministry of Production that helps maintain the quality, Prompt Brew that gets them prepared to send it out, and us, we tell them where to sell it.
And here's the market. Mm-hmm. And that, you raised several good points. I think one of the ones, too, that we'll highlight here before we have to cut away is what I want people to understand about Pisco, and I know you obviously know much more than I about this. It is almost like consider an appellation where we talk about wine in France or we talk about wine in the United States. What is allowed in production, and we'll get into that with some of the future interviews, but it is a controlled product, meaning that it has to be made to a certain standard and has to be made a certain way.
Correct. In order to be called a Pisco, you have to follow the laws of production in Peru to the letter. So it is a very controlled, very measured process. It's that's where us and our competitor to the south have some differences, because we maintain a very strict control over the production. Whereas our competitors to the south allow a lot more, I'll call, adulteration to the product.
Yeah, just so people know, we are talking about the country of Chile, and the Pisco that comes from that country is not Pisco from Peru. It's a different thing. And so, I mean, this is educational. We want to bring this up to people. Yes. And I appreciate you. We have to name names so people know. We don't want to make them go look at a map, Eric.
All right.
That's hard in this country sometimes. Well, Eric, so you're here for the week. Are you here? Or how long are you here for in town?
Yeah, until Saturday. So we have our tasting room on Thursday from 3 to 5 at the Hotel Monteleone.
Great.
So any of your listeners that can make it out there, we would absolutely love to see
you. I think this will air after that's over, but I will be sure to report on how that tasting room goes, because I'll be there. Folks, we just chatted with Eric Aponte, who is here with the Peruvian Government Trade Commissioner. And Eric, thanks for a wonderful event. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Friends, come on back to the NOLA Drink Show. We'll be right back. We're talking Pisco.
Hey, ladies. Are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls' night out? Grab a bottle of Capitello Wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello wine. Cheers.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in the Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans. And in the podcast interwebs, wherever you may be, thanks for listening to the show. Yes, as you know, we're here at Tales of the Cocktail 2017. By the time you're hearing this, we're done with Tales. If we've all survived, we are done with Tales of the Cocktail 2017. We're talking Pisco. We're here at the Pisco event at Calcasieu. Pleased to be joined by really a true pioneer in the world of Pisco, Diego Loret de Mola from Barsol. Man, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here once again.
Absolutely. And Diego, I was telling you right before we went on the air that I had the good pleasure of interviewing our mutual friend, Nathan Dalton, who actually just walked in, and Matthew Noel, who is a filmmaker that made a documentary.
Pisco Punch movie.
Pisco Punch, a cocktail comeback story, which was a great. And so your reputation preceded you. I just met you in person for the first time today, but I had heard a lot about you, Diego.
I hope that everything you heard is a good thing.
Anything that ended up on the radio show was good.
Okay, sounds
That's
great.
All I'm going to say.
Yes, this is a long story. You know, we started 17 years ago, and to me, it's been a pilgrimage. You know, it's been my Pisco pilgrimage. You know, I came from a very different industry. The industry was financial, so it was very cutthroat, very intense, lucrative, but actually not fulfilling to my heart. So when I made the decision that I'm done with this, and I wanted to look for something new, that it would be very rewarding, heart-fulfilling, and actually something that would stimulate me to be a better person, I found myself, you know, heading down south where I come from, Peru, and I ended up in the Valley of Ica, really tasting something that I never tasted
where,
before.
Where in Peru are you from, Diego?
I'm originally from Lima.
Oh, you are, okay.
The capital and the coastal city. But Ica is 310 kilometers, you know, 200 miles south of Lima. And it's a beautiful area, you know. It's in the middle of a desert. It's very desolated with the Andes really hidden towards it, you know, about 50 miles, you know, inland from the coast. But there's nothing but just bare desert. And all of a sudden, this river takes a geological turn and makes 100 kilometers of beautiful valley, rich, about 450 meters, you know, about, what is it, 1,200 feet, you know, above sea level. Very perfect for producing agriculture, you know, anything you can think of, from mangoes to avocados to asparagus, but the best is the grapes. And the grapes have been planted there since the 1500s till today. And the Spaniards are the guys that, you know, brought them in, made their wine, because originally they wanted to make it for sacramental purposes.
That's the official story.
Yep. And they ended up distilling it, you know?
Right, right.
And and funny enough, you know, I come here, you know, 500 years later, and I'm just in love with the area. I'm in love. I had been there since I was young, but I never saw it, you know, as an adult.
Well, so that was my next question. So did you travel there with your family or something? Is that
my
how
best
did you...
friend.
Okay.
My best friend since I was born, you know, says, come with me, you know, you have nothing to do anyway, you're unemployed. So come with me down south. I bought a little piece of land that I'm going to call it my farm. And we showed up and I said, where's the farm? You're standing on it. No, I'm standing in the middle of the desert. And he says, no, the Israelis have brought a technology of dripping irrigation, and we're going to be able to really harvest this land. Fast forward 17 years, the whole desert is green with those beautiful farms producing table grapes, mangoes, citrus, mandarin, clementines. You think of and a ton of, you know, pisco grapes, which at that time I only knew that pisco was pisco, you know, but right. The variety of grapes that then I found was great. And pisco was forgotten for a long time in Peru because we had a military coup
right.
in 1968 right. that eliminated the agricultural business. So vineyards were gone.
And we actually, when we did the interview with the documentary, we talked extensively about that. And I actually just re-ran that interview recently on the show. We talked about The Shining Path. We talked about how kind of the theory, and tell me what you think about this, that because the beverage is so important culturally and integrated culturally, had it not been, it may have actually disappeared. Meaning that it was important to the families who drank it for social reasons and traditionally, yes.
It was a legacy. So even though the government and after that the terrorism fade away, you know, everything that was industrial, you know, as a category, the tradition never left the valleys and the little families where it comes from. So we're now in the renaissance of Pisco, going back to the roots, to the little families, to the agricultural families that make these, you know, crops. Because today the land is so valuable that Pisco doesn't yield what they can yield with avocados or asparagus.
Right, okay.
So we're really working shoulder to shoulder with hundreds of small families that have kept producing these grapes for 5, 6, 7 generations now, and they have done it because their ancestors did it. They may have a secondary job where they make money off, but this is something that they will not stop doing, and that's where we focus. And we said, first, I tried the pisco from these families that was not commercially traded, you know, 20 years ago, and I said, wow, I never realized that pisco tasted so good. Remember, pisco disappeared the decade of the 80s, 90s, into the thousands. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, this is tasting so good. I said, I gotta bring it to the world. I gotta do something to really make everybody understand where this is. And many times they ask me, do you sell pisco? I said, no, I sell Peru in a glass, because pisco is not just a spirit. Pisco is the ambassador of our culture, of our legacy. It's in our music, it's in our songs, in our lyrics, in our chronics. It's in everything that we do. You know, we celebrate with pisco the birth of a child, you know, the disease of a relative. We celebrate with pisco a lot of what makes us feel at home. And for me, living in America for 32 years, that was my connection back home. I wanted my kids
right.
to connect back.
That makes a lot of sense.
And And what in turn happened is I start selling it forward, and then I'm connecting to the world. And I tell you, in the last 17 years since I started, I've made the best friends in an industry where there's no egos, but there's celebrations. I've made friends with the greatest guys that actually make food, great chefs, or make great cocktail bars, and they're very proud of what they do. And I can be so thankful and happy, you know, for all these last 17 years.
That's great. Well, and do me a favor, Diego, because we have about we got about 2.5 minutes left. We're tasting some of your lovely Barsol Pisco. Which one is this one?
This is one grape that is called Quebranta. Quebranta descends from the original grape, the missionary grape. And this grape is a non-aromatic grape, so you shouldn't be having flowers or fruity notes, but you should have that grape that is sweet.
A little bit spicy at the end.
Yep. Has a little bit of cacao, you know, and chocolate notes, a little bit of nuttiness to it.
Absolutely.
And this is a quintessential Pisco grape because 90% of the Pisco production is based on this. This is a go-to for the Pisco Sour, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, with Barsol, with your brand, which is probably the most, I guess, widely seen brand, or Portone maybe, but you guys carried the flag
the
into the States.
We have the largest distribution in the world right now.
There you go. Now, how many lines do you have? How many different Piscos do you actually make typically?
We make about 10 different varietals of Pisco. And each one is, we have 8 grapes that we can make Pisco of. You know, we can make Pisco from, but we concentrate on 6 of them. But the 6 of them, we can make them in regular Pisco, which is very simple. You know, you crush a grape and the juice is fermented into the wine is distilled in a copper pot, and the resulting spirit is a Pisco. But we also can make them in what we call the green must Pisco, which is partially fermented juice we distill. So more or less, it takes us 4 bottles of wine to make 1 bottle of regular Pisco.
Right.
It takes us 10 bottles of wine to make this one. But it's such a sublime, expressive. So in all of a sudden, our 6 become 12. You know.
Now, I've actually had that one. And the reason why is our another mutual friend of ours, Marvin Allen.
Yes, sir.
Has been on the show. And you gave him a bottle of that. And we tried that on the show a few months ago.
I have to say that Marvin is a pioneer of Pisco in NOLA. He was the first one to put it on his bar, the Carousel. And boy, has he done such great introduction to the people that visit him.
So how long, and Marvin's, and he's a great guy across the board, right? So how long are you here in town for, Diego?
I always come for the full length of Tales of the Cocktail, and then I try to come another couple times, you know, before sometime in April, May, and then in November. But now I'm going to be here 7 days, and I would love if people can, you know, that are listening to this and are attending Tales, come and see us on Thursday from 3 to 5 p.m. We're going to have the Pisco Pavilion where all the producers were showing our spirits and cocktails. And then on Saturday from 3 to 6, we're doing a dynamic duo at Sobu. And that's going to be full of, you know, great Pisco cocktails.
Now, Diego, as I mentioned to Eric, by the time this airs, Tales is going to be over. So I will be at most of that stuff, and I will report on it after. And then I'd love to, when you come back to town, I'd love to have you come on the show for a little bit more chat and
it
taste.
It would be my pleasure. And thank you very much for having me over.
Absolutely. Diego, thank you so much for taking time. Friends, we just chatted with Diego Loret de Mola, who is the owner of Barsol Pisco, one of the best Piscos really made. And thanks for sharing the tastes. And friends, we're going to be right back here on the NOLA Drink Show. Probably talk a little bit more Pisco. Come on back.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on, great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region. Producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay. An ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood. Or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak. To our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
With the season's beautiful weather, it's a perfect time to take a drive across Lake Pontchartrain and visit New Orleans' only local vineyard and winery, Pontchartrain Vineyards. Our tasting room is open Wednesday through Sunday from noon till 4, or by appointment. Come enjoy a flight of our wines in our classically styled French Provençal tasting room, or pack a picnic lunch and enjoy a bottle of wine on our patio overlooking the vineyard. While you're there, ask about our wine club. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Want a great alternative to Over Oak Chardonnay? Try Yamhill Valley Vineyards Pinot Blanc, a wonderfully balanced white wine from the oldest family estate in McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. It's round and ripe like a Chardonnay, but without the heavy oak and sweetness of big commercial corporate Chardonnays. Yamhill Valley Vineyard Pinot Blanc, a great value under $20. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirits Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and podcast land, wherever you may be. Yes, we are at Tales of the Cocktails, friends. And as you know, hey, we're talking Pisco. We're here at a special event sponsored by the Peruvian government and their trade commission. And it's all about Pisco here as we kick off the first day of Tales. You're here in this after. Pleased to be joined by Johnny Schuler, who is the owner and founder of Pisco Portón, no?
Brian, great to be here. Thanks a lot. Great to be in New Orleans.
Absolutely. Welcome Fantastic. Back. I know this is not your first time in New Orleans, Johnny.
No, I think it's my fifth trip to Tales, yeah.
Fifth trip to Tales. Had you been
Always
here?
Always a pleasure to be here.
Had you actually been to New Orleans prior to Tales at all?
Yeah, when I was, I remember back in history, I went to high school up in this New York, and this is back in the 60s, and I remember one of the Easter vacations, my dad and mom came up with my brothers, and we took a trip down to New Orleans.
Okay.
Yeah, and I still remember several restaurants, and I still remember, the memories are still there, right? I still remember, so happy to be here, always.
That's great. Now, you did spend some time going to school here, but you are originally from Peru.
Yeah, I was born in Bolivia. I lived all my life
in
Peru.
You were born in Bolivia, okay.
Educated in the States. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I live in Peru. Okay.
Now, how did you get yourself involved in the Pisco business?
Well, it's a little complicated, a big story. Pisco was a product that I had restaurants. I was born in a restaurant. My father had restaurants. And when I was young, Brian, when you're a kid, you're sort of sneak behind your dad's bar and you pick up a little drink or something.
Sure,
like that.
I've heard something about that.
Yeah, right? And John Scott. And, you begin to taste this thing and you don't like it. Not harsh, strong, very difficult. So I opened my first restaurant in 1977. And when the bar manager said, Mr. Schuler, well, what Pisco are we going to say? I said, the cheapest you can find.
Now, was this in Lima or Loria?
Okay, Lima, yeah, Lima. Okay. So I said, buy the cheapest. I don't know. Pisco for me is not, I drink scotch and soda, right? So Pisco was not anything. And then years went by, and I became a taster, a professional taster. And then I was invited by a friend who said, Johnny, I've got this Pisco competition going on in Arequipa, the city south of Lima, south of Peru. And I said, what are you tasting? I said, Pisco. No, I don't drink that stuff. I don't like it. I don't drink it. He said, Johnny, you're a taster. Organize a tasting. So I went, organize a tasting. And then he said, okay, now sit down and taste. I don't like it. But first sample came down, didn't like it. So I said, my God, third sample, my God. Then the fourth sample, Brian, I put it in my nose, smelled it, put it in my mouth, took a taste of it. And there was something magical happening in me. There's something like the sky lit up and I, the smoothness, the aromas of fruits, spices, flowers, the smoothness going down the throat. I said, what is this?
Now, was it something that the first few times that you just were missing the complexity and you were missing the depth of the beverage?
You have to remember that we had gone through land reform in Peru. They had expropriated everything, so it was a mess. The whole thing was a mess.
Yep.
There was no imports, so you couldn't get in restaurants. You couldn't get imported scotch. It was really, really, we were drinking local gin, local vodka. So it was really pretty bad. And then all of a sudden, I gave to taste this. I said, what is it? I said, Pisco. No, come on. I was already in my 40s, and I said, Pisco, is that? And I said, oh, my God, I didn't realize that there had to be good ones, right? And this was magical. This was And that day, Brian, I've never had a scotch again.
Are you kidding?
This was some 30 some years ago.
Wow, okay.
So it just happened. It just I don't know. It was, I always say it was love at first glass or for love at first taste. I don't know if Pisco fell in love with me or I fell in love with Pisco. From then on, every day, I began buying bottles, tasting this, and asking questions. Hey, Brian, how do you make yours? Why is yours different from Bob's? Hey, Bob, what are you different from Mary? Mary, what are you different from Joe? And I'd be not in an interest of making my own, but I couldn't believe that Peru was making such a wonderful spirit, such a beautiful spirit.
Now, when you do yours with Porton, do you work with independent growers in Ica, or how does that work?
I have to tell you that fortunately, we're one of the very few Pisco producers that don't outsource anything.
So you have your own estate?
We own four vineyards.
Okay.
We own our four vineyards. We have our own grapes. I use of the eight allowed by the norm. I grow six. I only buy one because I insist of not planting that one because I think that one needs altitude over 1,000 meters, 3,000 feet.
And which one are we talking about?
Negra Criolla.
Yeah, okay. Uh-huh.
All right? So that's the only one I outsource, going out to about 1,000 meters above sea level, a little valley up in the Nazca Valley. I buy it from an old man over there, and then I bring it into my distillery. We own two distilleries, four vineyards, and we make everything ourselves.
Right. Now,
we're in Ica, which is 300 kilometers south of Lima,
right?
The wine-producing area of Peru, region of Peru.
Thank you. And the point that I wanted to make here too, and we've touched on this before, but that it's a very terroir-driven beverage, and I think a lot of people don't necessarily because when you think spirits, and I mean, there's a truth to that in all spirits, but I don't think
nobody realizes how strong
to the degree exactly
it becomes, because when you have eight different grapes that you can make, for instance, I can explain to you and your listeners that. Two of my vineyards are at the entrance of the Valley of Ica. The kilometer is 281 of the Pan-American South. It's 281 kilometers south of Lima. It's called Guadalupe. In Guadalupe, I have two vineyards where I have my Quebranta and my Moyar grape. And then you drive through Ica and you pass Ica. So you're in kilometer about 320, which is about 25 miles south of where I am, and have two other vineyards, and I have my aromatics over there. I have my Quebranta, my Alvilla, my Moscatel. Although we're in the same valley, the valley closest to the northern part of the Ica Valley has a different climate and a different soil than the valley on the south.
Right.
And that gives you the terroir, and that gives you, this is why I insist when I'm planting 10 new hectares of grape right now, today. So they say, the engineer comes up to me, Mr. Schuller, what are you going to plant? We don't have Italia here or Torontel. Hey, Santiago, over here, only Quebranta or only Moyar.
Mm-hmm.
All my Toronteles and my Italias are planted in Pueblo Nuevo.
Where they need to be.
Out south, sure.
Right, and I think that's the important
terroir
part.
Terroir.
Yeah, terroir is the key part of this.
It's really important, yeah.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't necessarily, with wine, we all understand
that.
Sure,
most
of the listeners,
which
is made from wine. Exactly.
Sure.
And that complexity, exactly. And so, Johnny, that complexity that we get in Pisco is because of that.
Because of that, sure.
Right.
The beauty is that. The advantage is the amount of sun you have and the fact that, as Diego and Dale said before, it doesn't rain down there. So I have the yeast on the skin. That little white fuzzy thing on top of the skin.
Wild yeast.
Natural yeast, right?
Yes.
So I don't have to look for yeasts. They're endemic. They're there. And the yeast in the northern part of the valley is different from the south part. It's
right.
A different yeast, right? So it's a different strain. So because I think everything is, the Pisco needs that. Pisco is not just going down there and buying grapes from somebody, having somebody crush them for you, and then going to a still and lease a still for a couple of hours and distill it. I think it's more than that. It's serious business, and you have to take care of your Pisco since the way or at the beginning and the way how you choose the root stock you're going to use, which I bought in California, Paulson, which I bought from Davis, and then how you're going to graft it, when you're going to plant it, how you're going to Like having a kid, like having your children.
Absolutely.
It's the same thing.
It's like making wine. I do want people to understand that.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
And that's a really important thing.
All that.
It is all that. And that's, sure. I think, one of the things that really makes it so unique and special. Well, Johnny, we got about 30, 40 seconds left. Can you tell people online where they can find Pisco Portón, connect with the brand a little bit? And I know we can find it in the stores, but tell people where they can find you.
Pisco Portón is all over the States today. I think it's in all the liquor stores, and pretty much all the mixologists love it, and they're using it. I was talking to Brian now. To Kevin now at the Carousel Bar. And I've been to several bars in these last days. I like to drink, Brian. I come to New Orleans with my Sazerac.
I'm with you, Johnny. Yeah, I'm with you.
I come with my Sazerac. I respect my Sazerac, my Ramos Gin Fizz.
You have to.
So I go for my Pimm's Cup, I go to my bars here in NOLA to have my drinks. But we're all over. I think Portón is doing very good. I think your client, your listeners, and my clients have to understand is that there's just more than making Pisco in Portón. There's a lot of passion. I employ 120 people. We are a small company, but we pride ourselves on trying to make the best product in the market.
Great.
I am the master taster, the master drinker, the master producer, but my team is the one that makes it all, right?
Great. And is it PiscoPorton.com? Is that the
PiscoPorton.com.
Okay. P-O-R-T-O-N, friends. Johnny, thanks so much for taking time to chat with me. I appreciate it. And good to get to know you. Friends, hey, we're here on the NOLA Drink Show. We're talking Pisco. Come on back. When your kisses fail to move,
and your rap ball seem to groove. Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe, named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner. The Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bageau heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today, Miro Cellars.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event, or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans. And in podcast interwebs, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening to the show. I appreciate it. As you know, we are here at Tales of the Cocktail 2017. By the time you're hearing this, Tales of the Cocktail is over. I may be done with two. I could be spent as well. But we're continuing our mission, covering a little bit of Tales of the Cocktail. And we are chatting here with Paul Hledko from Few Spirits. Man, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Brian.
Absolutely, Paul. It's a pleasure to meet you, man. And so we're actually sitting here in your hotel room here on Delphine, 300 block of Delphine. Nice spread you got here, man.
We got a great spot. We've got a team here with Few, and we're getting really taken care of. The whole city of New Orleans really opens up its arms for Few and Tales of the Cocktail. We've come in here for a couple years and always have a great time, but the thing that really kind of stands out is the warmth and the generosity of the people here in New Orleans.
That's nice to say. I appreciate it. I thought when you were going to go with warmth, I thought you were going to say the heat and the humidity, because we got that going on now too, man.
Yeah, it's not that bad. I'm used to being really horrible. And actually, when we got off the plane, I kind of turned to my friend and said, well, this heat is not that oppressive.
We haven't hit that August level, man, and that's when you open the door and you feel like somebody punched you in the chest. We're not quite there yet.
Yeah, the weather here this week has been fantastic.
It's not bad. We got another couple gears or two to go before it's, as I like to say, we're on the long, slow death march to August.
Nah, you'll get there, but the city is just a wonderful place to be, and I love coming here, and I hate to leave.
Well, we appreciate having you here, man. So tell us a little bit about Tell us a little bit about Few, and tell us, we were chatting before we went on the air, talking about music, because that was something you and I share in common. So how did you get involved in the liquor business, man?
You know, I got involved in the liquor business, you know, frankly, because it seemed like a good idea at the time. I spent all my life trying to be a creative person and make new things. I've made beer, I've made guitar effects pedals, I've made music, bacon, sausage, cheese. My wife gets driven crazy by all the stuff I like to create. And then I had this crazy idea of making liquor. And I've got a little bit of family history with the beer business.
So tell us about that, man.
How's so before World War II, my grandfather's family owned what is now a major brewery in the Czech Republic. You know, a lot of people have heard in 1939, you know, the Germans invaded everybody and their sister. And it's kind of a big deal. And people have heard
was
about
that
it.
Thing.
Yeah. There's a whole thing. Europe dissolved. It was
a
big
movies,
thing.
Right, right.
A lot of movies. Inglorious Bastards was a thing.
That was right.
It was a big deal. But as part of the invasion of Czechoslovakia at the time, my family lost the brewery, and in fact, the entire family got shipped off to the camps, and only my grandfather survived. And so after the war, you know, he spent the rest of his life trying to get it back, and never did. And when he died, it kind of struck me that if I didn't do something to reconnect or build on this family legacy, it was going to be gone forever. I didn't really like that. You know, family, I think, is something that's really important to me, and I'm sure it's important to you. And, you know, the fact that I love my family doesn't make me special. But I didn't want that to happen. And so we had this idea of making booze, and I've got this family history, and it's a way to kind of build on that. And I just kind of saw making, you know, spirits as a way to connect over the generations with my great grandparents, who, you know, I never got a chance to meet, but do something in a positive way and build instead of tear down, instead of raising a fist to the sky and saying this is unfair. You know, I can actually make something and I can build something, and, you know, maybe someday my grandpa will be proud of me or what have you. I talk to my grandma enough now that she just gets such a kick out of Few, because he would have loved it if he had a chance to see it.
So that's really cool, man. So wow. Did you, aside from the family connection, then, did you mention you made beer and these sorts of things? How did you get then into doing distillates? Did you have a science background in this, or did you just start cooking stuff in the kitchen, man, and making stuff in the tub?
Well, making stuff in the kitchen, making stuff in the tub, that's a felony.
Yeah, we didn't have to say anything like that. We're in Louisiana, man.
Still a felony here, as far as I know.
Yeah, but statute of limitations has run out.
Yeah, actually, probably has, but you know, even then, it's dangerous. I would never recommend doing that. But yeah, I'm an engineer. You know, other things I've created. You know, I used to build custom guitar effects pedals. So, you know, hearing a sound in your head and translating that into wiring is very similar to tasting a taste in your head and then converting that into beer, converting that into distilled spirits. So, you know, a lot of what, you know, Few is that vision, and that I taste something in my head and I need to figure out a way to make it come out. And, you know, we use that science, you know, we use the science of distillate to create that art.
Now, you chose, so we're doing, we're going to taste a little bit here and stuff like that. Well, let's start with the gin, man. So, well, tell us about your gin.
Sure. So this this one is our breakfast gin. You know, everybody thinks that gin is just a breakfast drink, and it's just not. You know, you could actually drink gin any time of day, but we wanted this one to kind of call that out and bring attention to it. And so it's a very soft gin. When you are drinking your gin for breakfast, you want it to be relatively easy to drink. Maybe it's not going to, you know, stand up and make you slap your mama. It's going to be a little bit softer, a little gentler. And so this gin is actually made from a bourbon distillate. It then is returned into gin by adding Earl Grey tea as well as juniper and just a little bit of lemon peel to brighten it up.
I really like it. I'm not a big super heavy juniper guy on gin. I'm on the record saying that, so no surprise there for anybody who listens to the show. And I find this has a nice balance to it, because I find that a lot of gins will actually be so juniper forward. A lot of the bigger brands, right? We know this. I'm not going to name names. That it kind of runs everything over, and I find that there's a little bit more interest in this one than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of juniper forward gins out there on the market, and I think there are a lot of very great juniper forward gins.
It's there's enough. We have
there's enough.
Right.
You know, with everything that Few does, you know, we are very well aware that our large competitors produce fantastic quality spirits. You cannot compete with somebody making quality spirits by simply making another quality spirit. You actually have to add to the conversation around spirit when you try to do that, because otherwise, who cares? You know, the worst sales pitch in the world is, oh, you know, this gin tastes just like Beefeater's, and it's only $20 more.
Perfect. Yeah, because the label's a little newer.
Yeah. No, that's not going to get you anywhere. That's not interesting. That doesn't add to the conversation. Beefeater's makes a fantastic gin. So we want to make sure that ours is different.
How long have you been doing this, Paul? When did you start Few?
Few has now been on the market just a hair under 6 years. You know, been producing spirit longer than that. You know, we've got brown whiskey out there. So we've been producing spirit longer, but we are coming up on our sixth birthday, which is kind of a really cool milestone for us. You know, I remember, holy cow, we've made it a whole year. We're not out of business
right,
yet.
Right.
You know, 95% of businesses fail in that first year. And then like that, I was like, holy cow, what have I done?
Then you hit the 3 year mark one. Then that's another one.
Right. And then, you know, 99% of businesses are gone within 3 years, right. And yet we're growing faster than we can maintain. Like what, what's going on here? And so the fact that we're at six, is just something that I think is really cool. It's really personally rewarding, and you know, it's cool. I get to do what I love every day, and that's, I get to wake up and make booze.
I like that life. That sounds like a pretty good life. I like the gin. It's pretty good. We got about 30 seconds left before we're going to take a little break here, Paul. Are you here? Are you guys in Louisiana? Have you been in Louisiana for a while with the product?
Yeah, we just launched in Louisiana about maybe 6 months ago. You'll see our stuff kind of run around here and there. You get some retail. You get a little bit of on-premise. In particular, one of my favorite places here in New Orleans is French 75. You can stop by and see the guys there and have a taste of Few.
Chris Hanna. Yeah, and when we get 30 seconds or so still. Did you guys start out kind of with a local distribution in the Chicago area in Illinois and then grew from there? Is that how it worked?
Yeah, we started off in Chicago. We had some really good growth there. And then all of a sudden, people around the country and all around the world started hearing tales about Few. And we were pretty lucky and able to grow pretty fast. At this point, we're now in about 28 states and about 35 countries around the world, covering across four continents. And it's pretty amazing that we're all doing this out of just, you know, 2,700 square foot garage down an alley in Evanston, Illinois.
Cool. Paul, we're going to take a little break here, man, and come back to another segment.
Thank you, sir.
All right, absolutely. Friends, coming back to the NOLA Drink Show. We're chatting with Paul Hletko from Few Spirits. We're going to taste a little whiskey when we come on back, so you should come on back.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with New Orleans' own Sazerac Company, makers of Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In case you haven't noticed, rye whiskey is hot, flying off store shelves and dominating the bar scene in New Orleans and around the country. Rye's spicy and assertive character is drawing in those looking for whiskey with a bite, but that equally pairs well with cocktails. Enjoy it in cocktails like the Old Fashioned or Manhattan, or simply savor it on the rocks. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy, suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
The French Market is a place where history is made fresh daily. From the historic Upper Pontalba building on Jackson Square to the ever-evolving Farmers Market, our six-block district celebrates New Orleans food, music, and culture through events, festivals, walking tours, health and fitness classes, and also children's workshops at the New Orleans Jazz Park. Visit our calendar of events at www.frenchmarket.org. The French Market, making history fun since 1791.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Thai Burger Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Baggio heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
Everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in today. I appreciate it. Yes, Tales of the Cocktail 2017 is here. Tales of the Cocktail 2017 is gone by the time you're hearing this, but I'm pleased to be chatting with Paul Holetko of A Few Spirits. And Paul, it's the first day, really, technically, of Tales that we're recording this. We're starting to kick things off, man. Are you geared up for the week?
I'm really excited. It's always a great week, and this week in particular, we've just got some great events that's going on. And just friends, like even just on the airplane down here, there were probably 10 friends of mine on the plane, none of whom I knew were going to be on the plane. And yet here we are. And like, it's, you know, the event of Tales, you know, I have no idea what it's like as a resident of New Orleans. But for those of us who come in here, it's amazing to be able to come and see your friends from all over the country and all over the world together. And you can't walk into a bar without finding somebody.
That's the cool part about it. It's the same for us here, is that, you know, you get a lot of people that I see once a year, I see this week.
Yep.
And from all over the place. So I feel like they come to me, which is kind of cool.
I wish people would do that for me.
So, hey, we're tasting some stuff, a nice gin that we tasted, and now we're going to taste the rye whiskey, man. Tell us a little bit about that.
Rye whiskey, I think, is, you know, I don't want to get like too far ahead of myself, but I think our rye whiskey is truly something special. Whiskey Advocate magazine named it the Craft Whiskey of the Year a couple years back, and I think it really continues to stand out in the world of rye whiskeys. It's a whiskey that we actually make all ourselves. We make it from scratch. We make it by hand. We bring grain into the distillery, and we ferment it with a wine yeast, and you end up with this really nice, spicy, sweet, slightly fruity rye whiskey that, you know, even years in, and all the acclaim and attention it's gotten, I think it remains a unique whiskey, one of the best on the market.
It's really nice. And actually, when you said that about using the wine yeast, it's very interesting because I not from an oxidative standpoint, but I get almost like a sherry-esque kind of note. I do get that mm-hmm. that wine note from that.
Yeah, you get some of that kind of stone fruity. You talk about sherry, maybe a little bit of pear. I tend to get a little bit of tart cherry. I always tell a story about, actually it was here at Tales, a couple years back, we had just launched it, and I brought a bottle to a party with a bunch of friends, and there was a writer there, now she's a friend of mine, and so I poured her a taste, and she's like, oh, tastes just like the Loire Valley. And I'm like, oh, that's really funny, because the yeast is from there. Like, you took away my whole...
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah.
you took away my whole story, so thank you. But it's been really funny. I've become friends with her ever since. But I think the rye whiskey is just truly something magical. And obviously here in New Orleans, you know, you do like some Sazeracs down here.
We do. It's a category that never went away. Like in a lot of places, it's always been here.
Yep.
And it's a nice category too, because it is, in the larger world, it seems to be getting a little bit more recognition and coming back.
Yeah, rye just continues to grow across the country. But obviously here in New Orleans, you guys know a thing or two about it, and you never forgot about it either.
Yeah, we never forgot about it. Exactly. Yeah, it's great. This will make a nice Sazerac, friends. That's really cool. Where do the grains come from with the mash bill and all that? Do you guys, is that grown locally? Where do you get most of your stuff?
Yeah, we get most of our stuff from as close to home as we can. You know, we are located just outside Chicago in Evanston, Illinois, which is of course the grain basket for the country. So it's not super hard to get good quality grain super close to home. So everything we get is as close to home as we can get it. While continuing to maintain that, you know, the quality of the grain is the number one thing that matters.
There's a reality, right, of where things can be grown. And if you need something and it can't be grown right in your backyard, you got to go get it somewhere else. There's nothing wrong.
You know, there is a reality. So, we tried out the breakfast gin. The lemon peels are not grown locally to Chicago.
I'm not surprised. Somehow that's not surprising.
It's not going to work very well.
It's not going to work very well, right?
But everything we get, you know, we do get it as close to home as we can. With at least within reason, so everything's as close to them as we can.
That's got to be a fun part of the gig too, right? You get to, when you're sourcing stuff, you get to go check things out, work with local farmers, work with different people, and go find what you want to find. That's got to be a good part of the job.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what we do is we get to work with people who share a passion for what they do the same way we have a passion for what we do. And whether that's, you know, working with farmers or working with bartenders, talking to drinkers who share the passion for whiskey that we do, that's super rewarding because everybody has this common language of spirit. And people gather over life's celebrations, and few spirits are a part of your happy celebrations. Bad things happen in this world. I wish it wasn't true, but it is. And people gather over spirits, and so a few spirits is there with people when they're having a hard time. And that's something that I think this business is, you know, I think that's the best part about it, is you get to share this passion and this common language, you know, this social glue that binds us all together, and few spirits is a part of that.
Yeah, it's great. It's always a bridge to something, right? It's something you know you're going to share in common with somebody no matter where they come from.
Absolutely. Sharing a drink with a friend or sharing a drink with family is...
Sharing a drink with a stranger sitting at a bar in New Orleans, man.
Yeah, they're friends now.
They're friends now. You got it. Well, let's do the... let's talk about the bourbon here, man.
Absolutely, man. The bourbon is a killer bourbon, you know, big and spicy. I always say it doesn't taste like Kentucky bourbon primarily because it is actually not Kentucky bourbon. We make it right there in Evanston. Again, all from scratch, all from grains grown as close to home as we can get it. We mash it, we ferment it, we distill it, and it does not taste like any bourbon you've had before.
No, it does not. Actually, tell us a little bit about what you're doing.
So lots of cinnamon, clove, spice. Instead of the wine yeast, we use a beer yeast for the ferment, and that gives us this great spiciness. Wonderful character, lots of heavy oak tannins and body and vanilla. All that sweetness you're looking for in bourbon, but really backed up with a surprising amount of spice.
It's interesting because usually, you know, when you think of bourbon, you think a lot of mid-palate viscosity and sweetness, and which is fine. But that's not what's going on here. I was actually, just as you said, there's a... I get a little bit of the fruit note up front, and then I'm really hit by the spice on the finish. It's actually it's very unique. It's actually quite different than most bourbons. It's a very interesting one.
Exactly. You know, we always say that a lot of people think our bourbon drinks like it's rye whiskey, and our rye whiskey drinks like it's a bourbon.
Okay, there you go.
So it's a little bit across category, and you can bring a bourbon drinker into rye, or you can drink a rye drinker into bourbon. But it does provide this really fantastic contrast and ability to have a fantastic sipping whiskey, and that whiskey continues to tell a story.
I like it. Now, what did you start with? Did you start making the gin first out of the gate? Was that the big...
We started making bourbon right off the bat. Okay. I started making rye right off the bat. The thing about making brown whiskey is it has to age. And so we made whiskey for as long as we could. And then we started making and selling gin, and continued to sell gin while that whiskey was aging.
Are you playing with anything new or in addition? Or are we kind of sticking with these three right now?
Yeah, I think our core is our bourbon and our rye. I love making gin because it's very experimental and there's almost no rules, so you can create what you want. That said, yeah, we always have more whiskey in barrel with all sorts of crazy experiments that we're doing, having fun and creating.
Playing with some different wood and stuff like that?
We're starting to play with a little bit of different wood. We're playing with some barrel finishes. We are doing a super cool and funky White Dog single malt. We're aging some of that White Dog single malt and letting it sit in barrels for a while. So I have no idea when that'll see the market, but that White Dog's coming out pretty soon. We have a lot. We do a lot of really fun stuff, ranging from smoked bourbons to brandy barrel bourbons and all sorts of really cool, fun whiskeys that tend to get released in small batches. Sometimes distillery only. Sometimes we'll sell them out in the world. We did a collaboration whiskey with the rock band The Flaming Lips.
Oh, really? Okay.
Again, music is a really important part of my life, and we ended up with the opportunity to collaborate with one of my favorite bands of all time, The Flaming Lips. So, of course, I jumped at that. Very fun project, super fun whiskey. It's different. It's unique. It's interesting. It's got a cool as hell label. You know, that whiskey is it's a psychedelic whiskey for a psychedelic band.
I like it. I like we were talking about the Grateful Dead man off air. I'll leave it at that. But that's pretty cool. Well, Paul, do me a favor. We got just a few seconds left here. Tell people where they can. I know French 75 at Arno's there with our good friend Chris Hanna has the stuff. Aaron Rose, I know, has some of your stuff. Where can we find you online if people are curious about learning more about the brand and stuff?
Online, you can find us at fewspirits.com. You can find us at Facebook at /fewspirits. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at fewspirits. Then you can find us at retail online. Everywhere from binnies.com to astrawines.com, K&L, High Times out in California, Ace Spirits up in Minnesota does a fantastic job, Drink Up in New York. We've got some fantastic retailers out in D.C., P Street Wines, and, you know.
Cool. There you go. And I know here if you're looking for off-premise Keith & Company over there on Howard Street here in New Orleans. Has it as well. Paul, thanks so much for taking time. Thanks for letting me in your hotel room, man. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Friends, come on back to the NOLA Drink Show.
Don't get no more salty than Baritan.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's bar bars, sips, and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our happier hour menu.
Sobu's happier hour every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
Get in the groove and let the good times roll. We're gonna stay until it's through our soul.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans, as you know, or in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening to the show this week. As always, my friends out there, and hey, you know, tell a friend what we do. You can hear us on the radio here in New Orleans, as you know, every Thursday from 3 to 5, and you can also catch the podcast around the planet. And we're on iTunes, Google Play Music, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher. You can get the show not only from the podcast version, but streaming on TuneIn, on Shoutcast. Got a couple more coming up on that front that we're working on, too. If you're more into the streaming radio situation, you can find the show there. Just go check out NOLADrinks.com.
Yeah, go check that out. And you can find the latest episodes of the podcast there, our show notes, more information, links to those who were on, and some other features that we like to share there. And yeah, pass that on to a friend. Always happy to hear from you as well. And let us know what it is that you want to hear here on the NOLA Drink Show. If it's about the world of drink and food, and I think you know, given even what we talked about at the beginning of the show, we take a very broad stance of what that actually means. It's a big world of drink and food out there with all kinds of avenues, connections, doorways, intricacies. I'm not good with that part because I'm not a very smart guy. But yeah, you know, hey, again, let us know what you want to hear. Best way to maybe do that is go to our Facebook page, which is just NOLA Drinks, and tell us what topic you'd like to see us tackle. Maybe a guest here in town or some particular area that you would like us to explore. We are more than happy to do that. Friends, some things I wanted to bring to your attention. I didn't get a chance to do this. One, we know, as always, generally do sometimes at the show, talk a little bit about the weather. And yeah, it's hot out there. It's really, really hot. It's really humid. And we've had a heat advisory, some things like that. I think we're looking at a heat index of 110, 115, something along those lines. Drink a lot of water. Be careful out there. It can be really hot, and it's sometimes misleading, maybe. And obviously, even though we're in the middle of August, we still have a lot of guests in town. And if you're encountering people out there, you know, keep an eye out for our friends who are supporting New Orleans and paying us a visit too. Maybe they're not quite ready to handle the heat, and you know, have a few too many hand grenades on bourbon. It might be time for a glass of water. That's sound advice any time of year, really. But there you go. So be careful out there, friends, and cooler times are ahead. I can't wait. Our good friend Tim McNally, who hosts the Dine, Wine, and Spirits show here during this time slot on the radio side of things, Monday through Wednesday and Friday, a dear friend of mine and somebody I owe a great deal of debt to for even getting into this business. He is the reason why I'm sitting in this chair talking to you today. And Tim also hosts a very cool TV show on the local PBS or one of the local public stations, WLAE, and it's called Appetite for Life. And as they do, I believe it's annually, they do an auction. And the auction benefits the programming there at WLAE, including Appetite for Life. And Tim has put together a very good list of things that you can bid on to benefit the station. And yeah, it's the website. Let me give that to you right now. It's WLAE.auctionanything.com. Again, WLAE.auctionanything.com. And Tim's got some cool staycation opportunities on there from the New Orleans Hotel Collection. Fine little boutique hotels around town, a lot of them in the quarter. Cute little spots to stay. All kinds of different types of wine collections out there. There's a Balvenie. We got some scotch going on. Let's see, some rum going on. Spirits of Mexico, that includes tequila, Milagro tequila, and what else we got there? Ancho Reyes chili liqueur, which is one of my favorite things. Actually, I love that. And the Monte Lobos mezcal, which was also good. And as I said, the Milagro tequila, that's there. And all kinds of other really good stuff. And again, lots of good wines. There's some food, some dining opportunities. Two Jags is there. Tableau restaurants there. A Sazerac gift basket. A couple different versions of that. Wines from some different wine shops and different winemakers. Tours, beers, more food from different restaurants. Lots of good things. And as a matter of fact, I think a couple things got added since I looked. So yeah, go check that out. Again, WLAE.auctionanything.com, and support station and support our good friend Tim McNally, and watch his show, Appetite for Life. The auction actually began yesterday, and it ends on Sunday. The show is on this evening at 7 o'clock if you're listening here on Thursday on the radio, 7 o'clock. And then the show is going to be repeated, and they talk a lot about the auction items and show and that stuff. And then the show will be repeated on Sunday at 5 o'clock before the auction closes. So go check that out and tune into Tim's show as well. Also, hey, if you're into beers, there's a beer event coming up here this weekend. It is the Bruziana. Oh, aren't we clever? Bruziana Craft Beer and Music Festival, Bruziana 2017. And it's taking place at the House of Blues. And again, that is this Saturday in the evening. And it's going to feature all kinds of different beers, of course. Who do we got? We got Bayou Teche, Chafunta, Port Orleans, Covington, Gnarly Barley, Parish, Tin Roof, Urban South, Abita, Nola, Great Raft, 40 Arpent, Second Line, Mudbug, Wayward Owl, and Royal Brewery. And that's kind of included in the main area there. And then if you want to upgrade to a more VIP kind of thing, there's an exclusive access tasting that will also include Louisiana Purchase Old Rail. My good buddy Matt Horney over there at Old Rail, right down the street from where I live, he has a
great, that is a great little brew pub. You can only get their beers there in Old Mandeville. Check him out, and I'm sure Matt will be there pouring beers. He's a good dude. Brew Carré, Parlo Beer Lab, Broad Street Cider and Ale, and Southern Craft, also a very cool brewery that I had a chance to visit not too long ago there in Gonzales. Good program that way, and they're going to be making some inroads into New Orleans pretty soon. Southern Craft Brewery, check them out. They got food for sale, all that stuff. Let's see, tickets are $10 for general admission, a 5 tasting wristbands, $20. And so if you pay $10, it just gets you in the door. You have to buy the tastings. A 5 tasting wristbands, $20. Unlimited tasting is $45. And if you want that foundation room access and exclusive brewery tasting, that's $75. So that's that includes pretty much everything there. If you go to houseofblues.com /New Orleans, you're going to find the event, friends, this Saturday. So go check that out. Lots of good beers. Looks like lots of good food. The bands, Dash Rip Rock, Where Yacht. I've never heard of them. Y'ACHT. So it's kind of like Where You At, but a yacht. I don't know if they have a boat theme, something like that. Sexy Dex and the Fresh, Jonathan Boogie Long, Jake Landry, and DJ Otto. So there you go. Check that out. Yeah, you know, I hope you enjoyed the show today. You know, just circling back on a couple of the interviews there, we found some of those very interesting. There was no real theme. If you know, last week we did a show on bourbon and talking about the 2018 Bourbon Festival. And then we were over there at our good friend's Barrel Proof talking about, you know, bourbon. I think I said that 3 times. And that was a theme. And then 2 weeks ago, we did a show also collecting some interviews from Tales of the Cocktail. And our theme was basically spirits producers from Mexico. That was what kind of tied it together. These were just ones that I thought were all kind of interesting conversations that we had with different people. Miriam Hendricks there from Ruta. Okay, I'm trying to say it. It's R-U-T-T-E. All right. I just say root, but then they told me I can't say it. All right. It's Dutch. Never mind. So R-U-T-T-E distillery and a couple really nice gins. You know, they had the London dry gin. The celery gin that we discussed was excellent. And it wasn't like one of these, as we touched on, it's not infused in that sort of sense. I mean, it is, but it's not this flavored stuff. It was just one of the predominant ingredients actually in the gin. So that was excellent. And then Geneva, of which I am a very big fan of, and it's sort of the forerunner, if you will, to gin. And it's great. There's a drink, go look it up online, called Death in the Gulf Stream, that features Geneva in the drink. I was turned on to that drink a number of years ago by my good pal John Peterson, back when he was still here in town, working the stick there behind the bar at Bar Tonique. Little shout out to my buddy John. And yeah, that's a great drink. Go Google that one and get yourself a bottle of Geneva and make one of those. Of course, Pisco, friends, you know, I love Pisco. I think you know that. And I think the passion that you see that came through in these conversations with Diego from Bar Sol and Johnny from Pisco Portone, I think is very, very interesting. And you know, it's such a terroir driven distillate, and I think it's something to be discovered, and more is coming into the market. There are more and more bartenders and others embracing the spirit, and it's a really interesting avenue to explore. The diversity is just incredible in the world of Pisco, and then the cultural connection to it and all of these things. If you get a chance, go back and check out some of our past podcasts, like the one that we did on Pisco Punch, a cocktail comeback story, a documentary about Pisco, but really about Peru. Very interesting conversation there. And then, yeah, chatting with Paul Hletko from Few Spirits, also some really interesting craft spirits, really creative guy. He's a funny guy. When we did the interviews, you know, we just ran 2 segments here, which is what we recorded. But I think I sat in his hotel room there on Burgundy for probably about 2 hours tasting stuff and talking about different things. A really interesting guy, a very smart guy, you can tell, and a very passionate about what he does. So I hope you enjoyed all those interviews. We still have a few more rounds, probably 2 or so shows, maybe a couple more going on there, where, you know, we're going to have stuff drawn from Tales of the Cocktail. So, hey, you know, check that out. Friends, I, again, appreciate you tuning into the show today. Hope everyone has a great weekend. And until then, cheers, y'all.